The Life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca, Podcast 4, Seneca and Tiberius. Welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. When we last left Seneca, it was AD 19. The Emperor Tiberius, who had been on the throne for 5 years by that stage, was having a crackdown on foreign cults in Rome. Egyptian and Jewish communities were most at risk, but any non-mainstream school, including Rome's first homegrown philosophical school, that of the Sextii, was a target. Fearing that his son's vegetarianism, which the younger Seneca had possibly taken up in the hope it would help his long-standing respiratory problems, would make him guilty by association, Seneca's father had dissuaded his son from pursuing the habit and forced him to revert to a standard Roman diet. Tiberius would remain emperor until AD 37. Of the years from AD 19 until Tiberius's death, Seneca tells us next to nothing about his own personal life. We have to piece it together from snippets he lets slip in his own later writings and the surrounding circumstances that have come down to us from other ancient sources like Tacitus, Suetonius, and Dio Cassius. Seneca seemed to have no axe to grind with Tiberius. Everything he wrote about that emperor, and he does so in several of his surviving works right up until his own death in AD 65, is either neutral or grudgingly admiring, but on a smallish scale. There's not one single remark, whether it's a direct comment about Tiberius or an anecdote involving him, that can be called derogatory or insulting. And Seneca was quite capable of calling out a bad egg ex-emperor when he wanted to. He certainly did with Caligula, the next incumbent after Tiberius, which is something we'll hear more about in the next podcast. So we have to infer that Seneca, A, considered Tiberius's handling of the state nothing to bitch about, and B, didn't have any personal run-ins with this particular emperor. And that's not surprising, really, because in political terms, Seneca was still a young man. He was still very much small fry. The ancient commentators on this era, whose works have survived, don't mention Seneca at all during this particular period. So can we work out what Seneca was actually doing during the years AD 19 to AD 37? Many modern historians say that Seneca spent much of this period in Egypt, but I can't find any evidence to agree with them. So let's indulge in a bit of historical detective work. The modern historians claim that Seneca's ongoing respiratory problems caused him to live in Egypt's healthier climate with his aunt, the same aunt in whose arms he was carried from Cordoba to Rome as an infant, and her husband, who Seneca claims in a later work, the Ad Helviam, held power over the province of Egypt. Now, the Latin verb that Seneca uses to describe his uncle's level of control is optinuit, which would infer he was prefect or governor of the province. Seneca also says that he held the post for 16 years, but the evidence for this, such as it is all over the place. And it also doesn't help us that Seneca doesn't bother to name his aunt's husband. The biggest problem is that a reconstructed list of Egyptian governors indicates that no single prefect held the post for more than 9 years around the period Seneca is describing. The longest serving of them was one Gaius Galerius, whose tenure ran for 7 years from AD 16 to AD 23. Moreover, we don't actually know who held the post between AD 23 and AD 32, or even if it was one prefect or a series of them. The evidence then, such as it is, would have to make Gaius Galerius the only viable candidate for Seneca's uncle. But what about the discrepancy between this man's 7 years prefecture and the 16 years claimed by Seneca? There are two explanations. The first is that Seneca's account doesn't actually use the title praefectus or prefect, So his uncle, and let's assume it was Gaius Galerius, may not have held the top job in the country for the entire duration of his post in there. The second explanation is one that would fit more neatly into the 7 years tenure claimed by the list. In my opinion, the discrepancy between what Seneca wrote and what the list tells us could easily be attributed to an error by a later copyist. I myself have been privileged to consult the C.90.INF codex, which resides in the Biblioteca Ambrosiana in Milan, Italy. It's the oldest surviving copy of many of Seneca's prose works. But the important point is that this manuscript dates back only to the 10th or 11th century AD, and is itself probably a copy of a copy of a copy, and so on. I know from first-hand experience how difficult it is, even with modern tools, to separate out individual words and letters in documents such as these. So for copyists back in 900 or 1000 AD and even earlier, with no mod cons and probably working by candlelight, it must have been one hell of a job making a new copy of a predecessor that could have been in any state of disrepair. It's quite possible then that somewhere along the line, an ancient copyist mistook septem, the Latin word for seven, for sedecem, the word for 16. There is often, in these old copies, no space in between words, and letters are frequently squashed together. So, having seen this document myself, I can state that it would be quite an easy mistake to make. When Seneca repeats the figure a couple of passages later, the manuscript gives 16 as XVI, that is 16 in Roman numerals. Now, I can't see why Seneca himself would have switched from spelling the word in one passage to expressing it in numerals shortly afterwards. My suspicion is that the copyist has inserted the numeral version to reinforce the decision made about the difference between septem and sedecem shortly before in the copy. But be that as it may, Seneca, in that same later work, the Ad Helviam, reports the death of his uncle in a shipwreck and describes the stalwart heroism of his aunt as she ensured his body wasn't swept away in the tempest and managed to get it safely to shore. In the Ad Helviam, Seneca is actually addressing his own mother, Helvia, and encouraging her to have the aunt recount the shipwreck story so that Seneca's mother might learn from the aunt's courage. And it's at this point that Seneca makes a very strange comment. It's only a few words, but they've spawned massive controversy about his early life ever since. The actual words read, "And she will narrate to you an example of her own, cuius ego etiam spectator fui, to which even I was a witness." Now, this has been enough for generations of scholars to prove, in inverted commas, that Seneca spent the supposed 16 years in Egypt with his aunt and uncle, and furthermore, that he'd done so because of the respiratory issues that plagued him on a regular basis. But nothing here stands up to scrutiny. Firstly, the Latin term spectator is not as restricted as its English derivative, spectator. In many other Latin texts, it doesn't necessarily imply the actual witnessing of an event with your eyes, but can be used more in the sense of experiencing something. So here, I believe, Seneca is saying that he has experienced his aunt retelling her story. That is, he has been an onlooker on another occasion when she recounted it, and not that he personally witnessed the actual shipwreck. The Latin grammatical construction is ambiguous and could easily refer to my personal take on the passage. Moreover, there's actually not even anything in the passage to indicate that the shipwreck occurred on a journey either to or from Egypt. Secondly, as far as going to Egypt for health reasons is concerned, in the same passage of the Ad Helviam, Seneca mentions that his aunt nursed him through a lengthy illness. Now, this could have been at any time before or after she went to Egypt. If we recall that it was she and not Seneca's own mother who'd likely stayed in Cordoba, who'd conveyed him to Rome as an infant, the prolonged nursing stint could have happened at any time from his infancy onwards. And furthermore, Seneca's father was still in Rome. It's highly unlikely that the elder Seneca, who was highly ambitious for his sons, would have wanted his middle son away from the empire's centre of power for 16 or even 7 years at that formative age in which he should have been making a name for himself in legal circles and networking with important people. But perhaps the most compelling evidence that Seneca never went to Egypt, for me anyway, is that nowhere, and I mean nowhere, in his extant prose corpus, which covers 3 consolations, 9 moral treatises, 124 letters, a political satire, and 7 books on natural science, does he ever once mention a first-hand account of that country. Now, admittedly, probably half of what Seneca wrote in total hasn't survived, but he does mention Egypt in several places in his works that we do have. He even dedicates a whole book to the Nile in his encyclopedic Naturales Quaestiones, or The Natural Questions. In those mentions, he uses accounts from many other sources, but nowhere at all does Seneca relate a personal experience or give a first-hand impression of Egypt, its cities, or landmarks. Which is strange, you'd think, for somebody who supposedly spent between 7 and 16 years in the country. So, if Seneca wasn't off convalescing in the drier and healthier Egyptian climes, the odds are high that he was hanging around the great city of Rome itself. The years between AD 19 and AD 37 were interesting times, to say the least. To get a handle on them, it's probably worth reminding ourselves about who the major power players were around this period. Seneca himself certainly wasn't one of them. He wouldn't be old enough to step up onto the first rung of the cursus honorum, the structured ladder of political offices, as a quaestor until around AD 29 or 30, as a stipulation, unless an exception were made, was that a Roman had to be at least 30 years old to be elected to that relatively junior post. Only then could he be admitted to the Senate. In addition, and although it's not totally out of the question, I suspect that Seneca's respiratory problems kept him from active army service as a military tribune. He certainly never mentions any type of personal military activity in his writings. This was an era when younger upper-class men could be exempted from military service on a number of pretexts. The fall of the Roman Republic and subsequent centralising of power in one imperial office, that of emperor, had lessened the imperative for upper-class Roman families to jockey for power and fame, which was something they traditionally achieved through military prowess and conquest. This meant that there was no longer any major stigma attached to a son who didn't pursue a full-on military career, as there were now other options available in the political and legal arenas. But that was not to say that the optimum, an alpha male if you like in Roman eyes, was somebody with an illustrious military career and political and oratorical nous. But even a brilliant general might not want too high a political profile in an era where military success might attract adverse attention from a jealous emperor. Although Seneca couldn't have realized it at the time, the period between AD 19 and AD 37 would see events unfold at Rome in which factions would form that were to shape his future life. So let's identify the major players of the time. There was, of course, Tiberius, Emperor of Rome, the stepson and successor to the mighty Augustus. Tiberius's mother, Livia, the widow of Augustus, was still alive and still wielded considerable influence backed by popular support. Tiberius himself had a biological son, Drusus, who was, when the period of this podcast starts in AD 19, being groomed as Tiberius's successor. Tiberius had also adopted his dead brother's son, Germanicus. Both sons, biological and adopted, were accomplished and successful military generals. And we better not forget Claudius, a future emperor. He was the brother of Germanicus and a man who was to play a huge role in Seneca's future years. And then there was Sejanus. Sejanus was a piece of work. Born just like Seneca into the equestrian or knightly class, he was appointed commander of the Praetorian Guard, the emperor's personal security detail comprised of elite soldiers, in AD 14. Sejanus was ambitious, conniving, and utterly ruthless. Germanicus, Tiberius's hugely popular adopted son, was the first of this little lot to die. He perished in AD 19 under suspicious circumstances in Syria whilst on a diplomatic mission. Although it was never proved, many suspected the hand of Sejanus somewhere in the mix. Germanicus had been married to Agrippina the Elder, with whom he had many children, six of whom, three boys and three girls, were still alive. Upon her husband's death, Agrippina the Elder returned with her brood to Rome. There she championed a faction opposed to the growing political power of Sejanus, who by that time had the ear of the emperor Tiberius. Next to go was Tiberius's biological son, Drusus. Sejanus, by all accounts a handsome and persuasive individual, managed to seduce Drusus's wife, and the two of them orchestrated a campaign of poisoning administered over time to simulate natural causes, which eventually killed the heir to the throne in AD 23. The death of Drusus, coming as it did just 4 years after that of Germanicus, affected Tiberius very deeply. It seems to me that Tiberius had never really wanted all the hassle of being emperor. It's more likely that his mother, Livia, Augustus's wife, was the ambitious one, and it was she who wanted her son on the throne. Deprived now of both potential successors, Tiberius had had enough for a while. He gradually handed over more and more responsibility to Sejanus until, in AD 26, Tiberius retired from Rome completely and went to live on the island of Capri. Sejanus was now master of the greatest city in the world, and he made damn sure that only news vetted by himself would be passed through to the distant emperor. Sejanus wasted no time persecuting Germanicus's widow and her supporters, as well as anybody else who got in his way or who dared criticize him. He employed a team of professional political accusers, the Delatores, likened by Seneca to a pack of wild hunting dogs, who would target somebody Sejanus wanted bringing down and sniff out or invent damaging information with which the target could be arrested and often executed. Authors were among those victimized. They had their works destroyed in what were probably the world's first public book burnings. Among these was one Cremutius Cordus, to whose daughter Marcia, Seneca would later dedicate a consolation. In that work, Seneca was incredibly scathing of Sejanus and made comments that would suggest his sympathies lay with the anti-Sejanus camp. For a while, the imperious Livia, Augustus's widow, kept the worst of Sejanus's excesses in check. But when she too died in AD 29, the reign of terror intensified. Sejanus now had pretensions to the throne himself. He'd wanted to marry the widow of Drusus, she who had aided him in poisoning her own husband. But Tiberius, perhaps finally getting wind of his praetorian commander's real intentions, vetoed that particular move. Germanicus's widow, Agrippina the Elder, however, was exiled to the island of Pandateria, where she was eventually starved to death 4 years later. Sejanus was now undisputed master in Rome. In AD 31, he got himself elected consul, the highest political office in the system under that of emperor. There were supposed to be 2 consuls per year, the idea being that when the Republic had been in full swing, they would serve as a check to one another. Sejanus made sure to get the absent Tiberius elected as his co-consul, thereby ensuring that he alone had complete control of the body politic. With the emperor a recluse in Capri, Sejanus had been the only visible power broker in Rome for 5 years, so it was no wonder he had his consulship celebrated as if he were acceding to the throne himself. It couldn't last. The relevant annals have been lost to history, so it's not certain if Sejanus attempted a failed coup or Tiberius finally woke up and recognised Sejanus for the threat he'd become. Whichever way around it was, in AD 31, the emperor had his praetorian commander tried and executed. Sejanus was dead, his strangled body eventually torn to pieces by a vengeful crowd. But the political turmoil wasn't yet over. Tiberius went on a witch hunt to ferret out and destroy anyone who had aided or abetted Sejanus. In addition, 2 of Agrippina the Elder's sons, Nero, not the future emperor, and another Drusus, both died as prisoners of the state in the early AD 30s. The third, Gaius, known by his nickname Little Boots, Caligula in Latin, would grow into a monster and eventually succeed Tiberius to the throne in AD 37. So who are those who were to become major players in Seneca's life had made it through to the year AD 37. Tiberius's days were numbered. Agrippina the Elder, along with her 2 eldest sons, was dead. Her 3 daughters, though, had managed to stay alive. Drusilla, the youngest, was not destined to play much of a role in the life of Seneca, but the other 2, Julia Livilla and Agrippina the Younger, would have a massive impact on the young senator's life. And then, of course, there was Caligula. By AD 37, Seneca was most likely a senator, having previously won election as quaestor, thanks again to that same aunt, who seems to have used her influence and probably also her wealth as the wife or widow of a prefect of Egypt to give him a leg up. So, Seneca's somewhere in his mid to late 30s, and if what is about to happen to him in the next few years is anything to go by, he's fast becoming a Seneca and a senator with a gift of the gab, and maybe even gaining recognition as an author. Seneca's skill with words is beginning to attract attention. He's networking hard, meeting all the right people, and hopefully forging alliances that will serve him in good stead in the years to come. It's perfectly possible that, with his literary inclinations and thirst for knowledge, Seneca has encountered Claudius during this period. The awkward brother of the late Germanicus also has a bent for study and writing. At this point in time, Claudius is still bumbling along, deliberately radiating a congenial and harmless persona. And why not? It's kept him alive in difficult times while other members of his family have disappeared left, right, and centre. It's also safe to say that Seneca has made the acquaintance of the daughters of the late but still revered Germanicus, Julia Livilla and Agrippina the Younger, now aged 19 and 21 respectively. He's possibly even politically allied himself with them. Both women enjoy massive public support and sympathy, courtesy of their late but still popular father, and both are forces to be reckoned with, but for different reasons. Seneca is about to discover he's up to his neck in a game to which he is still too new to be yet any good at. And Caligula is coming. So let's leave Seneca there for the time being. Please join me for the next podcast, which will look at the years 37 to 41, Seneca's years under the reign of Caligula.